It's deeply an honor for me to be able to introduce our next speaker, Congressman Jim McDermott. Congressman Jim McDermott, currently serving his eighth term in the U.S. House of Representatives, is a veteran of the U.S. Navy. Yes. Commissioned from medical school, he served as chief psychiatrist, Long Beach Naval Station, California, 1968 to 1970, where he treated Marines and Navy personnel for post-traumatic stress. This experience proved to be a defining moment in his own life. Resolving to do what he could to end the war in Vietnam, he resigned his commission and pursued a career in politics. Jim takes pride in his record of advocacy on behalf of veterans and active duty personnel. His very first act as a member of Congress in 1989 was to testify in support of expanding the readjustment counseling centers for veterans returning from combat. In the current Congress, he is the author of the Depleted Uranium Munitions Study Act of 2003, H.R. 1483. Jim is a member of the Advisory Board of Physicians for Social Responsibility and a life member of Vietnam Veterans of America. And I hope that we can get him to be a life veteran of member of Veterans for Peace.
He's a member of Chapter 92. We're proud to have him.
Interesting thing about Congressman McDermott is that he was, I understand that he was the first person in his family to graduate from college. And so he certainly has been a guy that came up from the grassroots. He understands the grassroots. And personally, I think he's one of our great hopes to walk in the big footprints of our beloved Paul Wellstone. So it's my great pleasure to introduce, to speak to you tonight, Honorable Jim McDermott.
It's always a mistake to speak. I was given the choice. You want to go first or you want to go second? Okay, so I made a mistake. I thought for a while I'll just stand up and say, amen. The Veterans for Peace president, Woody Powell, wrote that if it takes lies to start a war, only the truth will end it. Which I think is a nice end to Mr. Pitt's speech, and I think he's to be commended and I for giving us truthout.org. It's a place where you can read the things that he puts together and spread it to your friends, and I really applaud you for that. I didn't know I was going to meet a kid when I met the guy who wrote that thing, but what are you going to do? That happens to everybody. Like Bill, I appreciate very much your asking me to share some time with you in this historic setting. like most people who were involved in the Vietnam War, I didn't do very much with it. I didn't go around wearing it on my shoulder or talking about it. In fact, I was probably as invisible about the war as most until the last 6 or 7 years when we started a parade out in our area that's done by Vietnam veterans. And for the first time, I really felt like I want to go out and walk with those guys because I didn't play a very big part. He said he didn't do anything. Well, I was sort of around the periphery, and I didn't get over to Vietnam, and I didn't, but I saw up close and personal what it was all about. And for me to talk to people like you who really, many of you who really did things, horrific, horrendous, honorable things, I am deeply honored that you would ask me to come and be a keynote speaker. This city and the building that I came to originally when I came down here was the place where they signed the United Nations Treaty, as maybe many of you know. It was 58 summers ago, right now, that the nations of the world united in their war against fascism came here to try and fashion a workable multilateral arrangements to prevent more wars. It was also 58 years ago, yesterday and tomorrow, that the United States unleashed on Japan the ultimate weapon of the last century. So there's a feeling about what's going on in this city and what has gone on in the past that I think is really a great place for you to have this meeting. Our motivation then, when we dropped the atomic bomb, was fear. And indeed, it is fear, real or illusory, doesn't have to be real, it can be illusory, that motivates all war. And also, in this nuclear age, all peace. Fear of what the others can do is a big part of what motivates what goes on in Washington, D.C., and in the public in general. So, in my view, it's appropriate for you to meet here this week to consider again all the questions we must answer if we are ever to defeat militarism and overcome the politics of fear. We live in difficult times. Not since the Nixon administration 30 years ago have we had a war, a bad economy, and threats to our civil liberties converging all at once to challenge us. We can't trust our president, and he doesn't trust us. He did. He'd tell the truth. We're angry with each other, closely divided among those in this country at the moment whose patriotism consists in supporting the president and those whose devotion instead is to the U.S. Constitution. For reasons both fair and unfair, much of the world hates us. And since 9/11, the question on everybody's mind has been, why do they hate us? Now, President Bush always has a simple answer for things. And in this case, his answer is, they hate our liberty and our freedom. But I think the answer to the question of the 21st century lies in restoring the prominence of our lost goal of the common good. The United States suffered severe losses in the Second World War, but the war was not waged here. Our infrastructure was not devastated. Our economy quickly adjusted to a rebounding, robust consumer demand, and we did not walk away from our new role as a superpower. We approached the post-war world with a strong interest in our own prosperity and prerogatives, but we thought also a goal of achieving the common good for all nations. Our foreign policy took in the Marshall Plan, strong support for decolonization in Africa and Asia, and expanding foreign aid. Our domestic policies, the GI Bill for education, federal housing assistance, health care for seniors, livable wages, brought prosperity undreamed of by this population in earlier years. So we were looking for the common good, both abroad and at home. Then our objectives began to shift. The Cold War contest between the United States and the Soviet Union that stalemated at checkpoints in Korea and Germany led us to intervene in a civil war in a little Southeast Asian country that was seeking freedom from the remnants of colonization. You know, we revile the French all these days recently, but at least they were smart enough to walk away from Vietnam. And we blustered in and said, well, we can do it. Our arrogance led us to believe that we knew what Vietnam needed, so we exerted our military might to enforce our vision of democracy. By the end of our adventure in Vietnam, we had fallen away from both our search for domestic common good, and from our comfortable belief in our military dominance in the international arena. But the question you have to ask yourself is, did we learn the right lessons from our Vietnam experience? In my view, we did not. We were misled into that war because we have been conditioned by the politics of fear, which were fueled by selective releases of intelligence in the years before and during that war. Lyndon Johnson, Mr. Nixon, all of that. You remember it all. It's an old story, and the Cold War historians tried to remind us of that during last year's propaganda campaign to convince us that we needed to fear Saddam Hussein. In October, Fred Kaplan warned, "Intelligence analysis should be kept out of the hands of those who have a vested interest in the results." And you heard right here what happened at the War Department. Mr. Rumsfeld didn't like what he was getting from the intelligence community, so he set up his own. Kaplan reminded us of the classic gap of the bomber gap and the missile gap of the 50s, in which misleading intelligence caused us to spend billions to ensure our first strike capability to deliver nuclear bombs. Some of you may actually remember John F. Kennedy used the concept of complacency about the missile gap in his campaign for president in 1960. When he later discovered the myth, Kennedy characterized himself as a, quote, patriotic and misguided man. So what's going on now is not new. President Eisenhower, who understood better than most, warned us to be wary of the military-industrial complex. Vested interests, sometimes in the Pentagon, sometimes in Congress, sometimes in ideological think tanks, will use intelligence estimates for their own ends. I noticed in the program of the organization in the meeting today a quote from somebody. When I take people through the Capitol, I always take them past this woman's statue. Every state has two statues in the Capitol. So each state legislature tries to figure out who are the important things, who are the important people we ought to put in the Capitol. No one would guess, looking at this lady standing in this long dress, that Montana put a statue there of a woman named Jeanette Rankin. And Jeanette Rankin, as you may know, was the first woman elected to the United States Congress. She was a pacifist, was there in the First World War and voted against it, and voted against the Second World War, and at 90-something, she wanted to come back and vote against the Vietnam War. And Jeanette Rankin said, "There will be war as long as we have secret international relations and governments that protect special economic privileges." So the truth of what that woman said is right in front of our eyes again here in this country. The manufacture of crises to create a climate of fear, the selected use of fact and circumstance, has produced some sorry episodes throughout our country's history. In the last century alone, we had the Spanish-American War, the internment of Japanese Americans, the domestic Red Scares following both the World War and Vietnam. In each instance, intelligence was used and abused to justify a goal that betrayed our national principles and subverted the common good. Each instance bore the classic earmarks of secrecy and the misuse of the media to induce the consent of the governed. 20 years ago, President Reagan convinced us that national defense meant military superiority and a missile shield. He convinced us the UN was an ineffective forum for resolution of international disputes, and that we should go it alone in the world. The end result was we nearly bankrupted ourselves fiscally and morally, and as the Soviet Union imploded on its own. We were left with a world increasingly armed with weapons of mass destruction as more nations followed the example of the United States out of fear. Reagan further undermined the goal of the common good by blessing the ethic, and this is his true legacy to us. He blessed the ethic that it's good to get as much as you can for yourself and don't give any to anybody. You remember that campaign in 1980? He said, Are you better off today than you were 4 years ago? Not is our country better off or is the world better off, but are you? Everything was focused on ourselves rather than thinking about the common good for everyone. And it's as though you alone are an isolated individual without the privileges and obligations of community. Are you better off? Never mind anybody else. Well, during the Reagan administration, we participated directly or indirectly by proxy in military campaigns from Afghanistan and Lebanon to Grenada and El Salvador and Honduras and Nicaragua and Panama. Some of you probably are even veterans of those little adventures. A continuous series. There's a great book by Gore Vidal, Perpetual War to Have Perpetual Peace. Great book to read. It's a little short thing. You can read it overnight. The Gulf War accelerated our country's military predominance and for many confirmed the goal of global Pax Americana. But did it make us more secure? We are creating endless enemies. Before I went to work for the State Department, I was in Zaire. And before I went down there, I did some reading about the Congo. And this was during the era 87-88. And they gave me a book called Endless Enemies by a guy named Jonathan Quitney, who was a reporter for NPR and a Wall Street Journal reporter. And his theory in that book is that the United States picks a dictator and then backs them all the way until they're done with them, and then they back another one and follow him and create endless enemies on the way. And if you look through Afghanistan, Lebanon, Grenada, El Salvador, Honduras, and so forth, you see the same pattern over and over and over again. Now, resentments kindled by that military adventures were evident in the 1990s on terrorist attacks on our global outposts, the Khobar Towers, the U.S. coal, our African embassies, and even Oklahoma City. President Bush decided that the lesson from Vietnam and afterwards was that military overcapacity is essential for security and that ignoring the domestic scene was all right as long as you can keep the eyes of the voters focused on the tailhook landings on the Abraham Lincoln off the coast of San Diego. You're going to see that picture so many times. But the question you have to ask yourself is, why didn't he want to take the physical to get his pilot's license so he could fly? Bush began this complete destruction of common good for all Americans with the tax cuts that have depleted our treasury so that the needs of ordinary people could not be met while making a grotesquerie out of the defense. All of this was in motion before 9/11. Now, those mind-bending days and hours, the soul-shaking terrorist attacks on our own soil, merely put these forces into overdrive. It was all being started out in those first months. But, as was suggested, the best thing in the world for him was this event. Nobody felt secure at that point. Fear was rampant everywhere, even among congressional members. We had been in the Capitol when they told us, run for your lives. And we sort of looked at one another like, well, you know, where? I mean, what do we do now? Nobody had a plan. And it turned out that the plane crashed somewhere out in Pennsylvania, perhaps. But the issue at that point was everybody was afraid. Now, 2 years later, the War Department under Mr. Rumsfeld, to deal with our fear, has laid waste to two weak countries, while our domestic situation, both nationally and in most of the states, has gone into steep decline. Coming here to California, where they're throwing the governor out because, you know, there's a deficit or something, I don't know what this is all about, but it's going on all over the country. And they want us to think about what's going on in Afghanistan. And keep your eye on Iraq, and then look a little further, and you can see Iran. They've already been talking. Now, instead of calling us to make sacrifices, if we were at war, if that's what the president really believed we were in war, was war, for the common defense, to meet the demands of a war on terror, the president asked us to sacrifice? Of course not. He gave a few people a lot of money back and told all the rest of you to go out and shop and get the economy rolling, please. That's what the president called, that was the high purpose the president called us to, go out and shop. So we have not shown the spirit of the common good that we offered the Germans and the Japanese after World War II. The people of Afghanistan and Iraq have real cause to doubt our credibility in this regard. If this is what America is, and you as the taxpayers ought to be thinking about that too. Is this what you want to pay for, $4 billion a month, for what's going on in Iraq right now and ignoring Afghanistan totally? I don't think the president quite has figured that out, or he wouldn't be so eager for the election to come on. Now, one of the most personally gratifying aspects of my attempts to hold the Bush administration accountable to us and the United States Constitution is hearing encouraging words from people like you. People like you who oppose unilateral military adventurism and understand the necessary deceit and secrecy and the inglorious consequences for soldiers who carry it out in the name of our country. One of you faxed me an excerpt from Major Smedley Butler's famous statement. He's a two-time Medal of Honor recipient. Butler understood that, quote, war is a racket, something that is not what it seems to the majority of the people. A racket, he said, is conducted for the benefit of the very few at the expense of the very many. We go along with it, at least initially, out of fear. The events of 9/11 have unleashed primal emotions of fear and suspended the innate skepticism of the American people. You're in a very small minority who are so skeptical because you've seen it up close and personal. And you can't be sold by the PR blur that's put in front of you by Fox Television. Out of fear, this country has allowed itself to give away our liberties to the generals in charge of Homeland Security. Americans are regularly asked to be aware. Today's orange, today's red. Buy some duct tape, buy some plastic. Get an inoculation for smallpox. I mean, you could go down the list of all the things they've done to try and scare the living daylights out of the American people. They never let them calm down too much because then they got to get them up again. Got to keep that fear, otherwise you might not want to pay attention to what the president's doing on the deck of the Abraham Lincoln. You might wonder about your job and your wallet. Fear leads us to assent in policies that undermine the common good and make us less secure in an interdependent world. This is a small world and we're all close. All you have to do is look at the SARS epidemic, what happened, how quickly that happened all over the place. And you realize how interdependent we are and we cannot go it alone. I don't care what George Bush says, we can't do it alone. Now, the reason I joined in, the reason why I wore one of your white hats, and the reason I joined a club, is because I applaud the Veterans for Peace. I like the focus because your actions to expose this racket, to pierce that deceitful veil of secrecy that shrouds the options of war, is very important, and I'm here tonight to ask you, keep it up. Don't stop. Like Bill Pitts, I'm not pessimistic because every day I watch, more and more Americans are rousing themselves from their fear-induced torpor to question the reckless policies of the Bush administration. Every day somebody says, well, my mother, who used to be in favor of this, she's changed her mind and she's come around and says it looks like Vietnam to her. Well, that's happening all over this country, folks. And what you did was lead the way. You can't stop leading. You got to keep pushing forward. But we who dissent need to raise our voices about the lessons of history's credibility gaps to underscore the danger of the current heedless domestic and foreign policies that make us less secure. Franklin Delano Roosevelt made that famous statement many years ago, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself." I think the only thing we have to fear is those who want to make us afraid. Fear paralyzes. Fear blinds us to the dangers that arise from the very methods we use to defend ourselves. The missile gap of the 50s, fear-mongering assessments of the enemy's capabilities, illuminates the racket behind this president's reckless multi-billion-dollar plunge backwards into biological and nuclear weapons of mass destruction. International agreements that were negotiated out of fear of mutually assured destruction, agreements that have kept our country safe for decades, are now unilaterally ignored and abandoned. The U.S. abrogation of the 1972 ABM Treaty is madness, in my view. It will not make us more secure. It will not make the world more secure. It will do nothing for the common good. The world was listening when the president said, "Well, we're through with that ABM treaty." North Korea got the message, right? Iran? They got the message. Pakistan? India? None of them are sitting back. They're defending themselves just like we are. Just like we are. Yes, in my view, war is a racket, a seemingly mindless, perpetual motion machine that just goes on and on. Considering the growing reliance on private corporations to carry out our military adventures. Guys get out of the military now, and they want to keep doing that kind of stuff, so they go around and they join, and we've got as many people over there, we got many people over there, who are hired by some company to do some kind of work. Who knows what they're doing, right? Not unfamiliar to people who were in the Vietnam War. There were a lot of people over there that were with a lot of different organizations. And we're doing it right now. They amazingly, I saw in the newspaper the other day, they announced that an American civilian was killed in a convoy over there. And it's the same, what was he doing there? We have got the private corporations putting people out there on the ground. When we don't have enough troops or we want them to do something that we can't do or we would be in trouble, well, you know. Didn't we learn anything from Oliver North? I mean, his misadventures in Nicaragua ought to have taught us the lesson about guys operating outside the military and sort of running their own game. Or recently, I mean, you know, things happen if you read the newspapers. I think it was Yogi Berra or somebody said, if you read the newspaper, you can figure out what's happening. We saw the downing of a missionary plane in Peru. And everybody said, "Oh, gee, that's too bad. Those nice missionaries. Oh, dear, dear, dear." Well, some private contractors working for the CIA gave wrong information to somebody, and we shot them down. I mean, we're all over the place doing stuff all over the world, and it doesn't make us safer. We only know what gets reported, and God knows you better read something besides the American newspapers. Because the private military contractors operate outside the rules and outside of much oversight. Contracts for less than $50 million are exempt from congressional oversight. So we can pass a check for $49 million out the door and never ask, what did you do with it? That's where you, as taxpayers, are. And now we're assembling a new coalition of those countries that are willing to barter with us to send their troops to Iraq. We say to the Poles, "Hey, look, we'd like about 7,000 guys from over your way. We'll give you $240 million. We'll house them and we'll fly them over and we'll take care of, pay them, we'll do everything. We'll arm them. And, oh, yeah, by the way, you guys make Kalashnikovs, don't you? Well, I tell you what, we want to buy 34,000 Kalashnikovs for use in the new Iraqi army. Now, think about that for a minute. I mean, we've been rounding up weapons over in Iraq, right? Going house to house, following the Second Amendment, I believe. Rounding up these weapons. I mean, there's some real ironies in this whole business that George Bush is over there taking guns away from people in Iraq and defending that you can have guns over here. But here we've collected all these guns, and now instead of using those for the army, no, we're going to buy 34,000 new Kalashnikovs from the Poles. The Poles are good bargainers. Don't ever think they are smart. They figured out what the deal was. The United States wants help. Hey, wouldn't you like this? We got a few things we'd like to sell to you. And so we said, oh, of course, whatever. As long as you give us the people. Now, when you look at that, you ask yourself, why do they hate us? As the world's superpower, we must lead in a new direction. Our best path to the common good and our own security is to clean up six decades of mistakes. Rather than spend trillions of dollars for space-based weapons, which is going to be another enormous boondoggle, let's repair the havoc created around the world by landmines and Agent Orange and depleted uranium mission. Rather than walk away from the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, let's clean up the 60 years of nuclear waste at labs and sites all over this country. Wouldn't that be something? And rather than abandon international biological weapons controls, we should lead the world in banning them from our planet. We should not be doing it. How can we say to Saddam Hussein, you can't have those weapons of biological weapons, but we have them. We're responsible. We know how to handle them. You don't. How do you carry on that kind of a discussion with the rest of the world? It's nonsense. As people, we must hold our government accountable to seek the common good that is the cornerstone of our U.S. Constitution. Our leaders must not endanger those they are sworn to protect without just cause. Our troops on front lines around the globe deserve to know clearly that they are making the world safer for their countrymen. Our national honor depends on it. The future of our children's children depends on what we do today. Defeating the folly of militarism by overcoming the politics of fear is the most critical campaign of this generation. 70 years ago, the legendary Will Rogers observed that conferences like this give everybody a chance to get sore at everybody else. But sometimes he says it takes two or three conferences to scare up a war. But generally, one will do it. And I hope that what comes out of the Veterans for Peace Conference is a renewed determination to declare war for peace on things that make people afraid. The time has come for us to stand up and say, what are we really afraid of? And I believe that we get a chance in 2004 to not make a mistake. So we ought to be focusing on how we change this government. If we have four more years of these guys, they're going to be everywhere you can imagine. The plans are all done. They were done back in about 88 or 87 or something. So they've just been waiting for a chance to unfold them and let us live through it. And this is crucial. The Veterans for Peace can lead the war against that kind of stuff. Thank you.